Begin Podfix Network transmission in 3, 2, 1.
What is up, plant people? Oh, it's a lovely Wednesday in late September in the year of our Lord, 2021. We're back with another episode of the Plantthropology Podcast, the show where we dive into the lives, careers, and general coolness of some wonderful plant people. I'm Vikram Baligi, your host and your guide through the plant sciences, and I'm, as always, thrilled to be with you today. How's it going? How is your semester or fall or September going? Hey, actually, today I'm going to go ahead and say the date. I'm going to back up for just a second. I used to say the date at the beginning of every episode, and I realized that podcasting is an evergreen sort of medium, and so maybe that didn't make sense, except for today. Today is the 22nd of September, in fact, and it's the first day of fall, which means in Lubbock, Texas, it'll probably be 103 degrees or 12 degrees and windy. Who knows? We could go either way. But I'm excited for fall. It's been a long summer. It's been a good summer, but it's been a long summer. And I always get excited about the leaves changing, about just transitioning into a new season and all kinds of things. So I hope that you're having a good fall so far, even if it's just been several minutes long by the time you listen to this. I've got a good one for you today, which I know I always say because they're always good. My guest today is someone that I've been trying to coordinate with since, like, I don't know, April or earlier. And we decided that, you know, maybe trying to schedule a podcast interview at the busiest time of the year in academia was a good idea. It wasn't. It took a long time. But Julia Cubans and I finally got to talk a few weeks ago. And I'm so excited for you to hear this episode. So Julia is a PhD candidate studying winter oil seeds and podcasting at the University of Minnesota, which is super cool. There is limited research in podcasting, and I'm always excited to get more science and more data about this thing that I love to do. So Julia is a plant scientist. She's worked with extension. She is a excellent researcher, a great teacher, and a great educator. And she also is the host of a wonderful podcast called Hooked on Science, where she interviews science people about science things. And even though she is also a plant person, she likes to talk about all things science and all kinds of science. So if you haven't listened to Hooked on Science, you definitely shouldn't. We discuss the podcast some. We discuss in this episode her research and her different experiences in extension, in academia, and in agriculture. And they're really fascinating. She's got a lot of different things she studied, and it's really cool research and a really cool body of experience. But we also talk about things like protecting your time and how to maybe work-life balance a little bit. You know, that is a challenge for all of us, I think. I think it's a big deal. So Julia's got some great tips and I think some great perspective on that, for sure. So without belaboring the point too much more, I am just going to jump into it. And I know y'all are going to enjoy this episode. I really enjoyed recording it. Stay tuned for the mid-roll for, I don't know, reminders, ads, whatever you think of to put in there. And get ready for a great episode of Plantthropology with Julia Cubans from the Hooked on Science podcast. And I think we were trying to get it recorded right around the end of the semester, which is the worst time to do literally anything as an academic. But I've,
that's true.
But I've got a Julia Cubans with me, who is a soon-to-be Dr. Julia Cubans at the University of Minnesota and is the host of the Hooked on Science podcast. So how are you today?
I am doing pretty good. I'm excited to be chatting with you. But yeah, we have, seems like trying to find times to record during the busiest times of the academic year, perhaps. But here we are.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
Yeah. And I'm super excited to get to talk to you because I love your podcast. I caught up. I was a few episodes behind, but I kind of binged it the past couple of days and actually just finished the most recent one this morning about seismology. And that was really fascinating, by the way.
Yeah, it's been such a fun time to learn about things outside of the plant discipline. I love being in plants, but it's just, it's so fun to learn from other people about things that I would never learn about in real life unless I really took the time to seek it out.
Yeah. Oh, and that, in my experience too, that's been one of my favorite things is just like, it's almost like I can read other people's work without actually having to read another article.
Yes.
Because goodness knows we get enough of that, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So tell us more about yourself. Where did you study? Where are you from? What got you into plants? How did you get to where you are today?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I am originally from Buffalo, New York. I moved to Vermont in just before high school, and I was always interested in the outdoors. I had some random, odd summer jobs helping with landscaping and, just random little things for family friends like that. But I really didn't get interested in plants specifically until right before college. I had a friend who was working on a small diversified vegetable farm. And part of the deal with that was you lived on the farm, you worked on the farm. It was just kind of really fun. And, difficult, farming's not easy, like immersive experience.
Yeah.
And she didn't want to do it alone. So she was like, do you want to do this? And I was like, yeah, it's summer before college. We get to spend some time together and I'll get to learn about something new. And that really spurred my love of plants. It was a lot of fun. I got a lot of free vegetables, worked really hard. Got a nice tan.
You know, but that is hard work. And I think that people, this is an aside, but I don't think people realize, especially like vegetable farming, how much work that is. Because like, I live in agricultural, country for sure, but it's mostly cotton out here. And so when we talk about agriculture, it's like, oh, well, you get on the tractor and you do the thing. And in vegetable farming, that's not really the case in most cases.
No.
So.
It's a lot of it's a lot of work on your low back, leaning over your hamstrings. I have definitely had some, friends, acquaintances who have romanticized it a little bit and being like, oh, it's so like nice and wholesome and beautiful. And it is all those things. But there's a lot of other blood, sweat and tears perhaps that goes into it, too, that people don't often maybe think about in the practical sense.
100%. So I guess that... Had you already planned on going into agriculture at that point?
No, at that time I was going into school as a chemistry major that quickly changed because chemistry is real hard.
Yes, agreed.
And so I was a geology major for a while, which, as you just mentioned, one of my recent episodes is on seismology. And so that was kind of a fun throwback for me to think about rocks again that I haven't thought about in a while. But it was really after my sophomore year of college at the University of Vermont that I said, you know what? Rocks, they're not my thing. I have really enjoyed working on this vegetable farm. I worked on it for 2 summers. And I was like, I think agriculture is a path that I want to pursue and learn more about in a structured sense. And so I switched and here I am now, still in agriculture.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things that I think, I don't know, for the people that really like it, it kind of gets in your blood a little bit. And it's like, I want to keep doing this. I enjoy growing things. I enjoy feeding people and learning more about it.
Yeah, no, there's definitely something infectious about, despite all the hard work, especially working on like the vegetable farm for me, having people come and put together their CSA baskets or having the Head Start preschool coordinator come and get stuff for the school lunches for the week. It was just so rewarding to see people interacting with agriculture and coming out to see the farm and just experience agriculture in the way that maybe is the kind of romantic sense of it, but have an appreciation for it that I think maybe doesn't exist in some other sectors of agriculture where people are like, well, I don't really care where my t-shirt came from,
right,
or whatever.
Oh, for sure. And you know, and you make a great point about that because, yeah, we grow. So in our region, I think I've said this before on the show, maybe I haven't, we haven't really talked about cotton a lot, but we grow about 25% of the total U.S. output of cotton within the like 20 counties around me. Up here on the Southern High Plains. So it's, you know, we grow about half of Texas cotton output and Texas does about half of the U.S. output. And so it is like big time cotton country. But even here with as much of a part of life as cotton farming is in this area, I think you're right. I think most people are like, yeah, OK, I bought a T-shirt. I don't really think too much about it, but I think it is, that's important, but I think it's probably even more important when you go to the grocery store and see something on a shelf that, oh gosh, there was a lot that went into that. Like that didn't just show up here. It doesn't, they don't, you know, lettuce doesn't just grow on the shelf or your tomatoes don't just grow in a bin somewhere. It's, you know, there's a lot of, like you say, blood, sweat, and tears that go into it.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely agree. And I mean, yeah, like driving around. I mean, I'm in Minnesota. It's corn and soybean country right here. And people aren't driving around being like, oh, that's that's what goes into the gas that's in my car. Or that's what's feeding the pigs that I'm then, you know, eating in my bacon at breakfast or whatever. There's definitely some like cognitive dissonance, but it was so interesting to see people connect those things in real time. On the farm.
That's really cool. So I guess that then sort of, you know, you got your bachelor's in, it looks like 2015, and then did you go right into your master's or did you take some time?
I took some time. I was pretty tired after school because I finished my degree essentially in 2 years after I switched my major.
Wow.
I had like some of those like chemistry prereqs, just like, you know, random things that most sciences need to have. But
yeah.
My ag classes I finished in 2 years, and I was real tired after that. So I could not fathom putting in grad school applications, and I was like, I don't even know if I want to do school anymore after this. It was a lot. So I took some time off. I worked for Extension. I had worked with Extension for about 2.5 years before I graduated, and so I just continued on with the same group. And I mainly worked on hops, which was really fun. As an undergrad, I had worked under a grad student as an intern on her hop projects. And so that kind of got my foot in the door. And it was just a fun, interesting crop to continue working with for a while. And I figured might as well keep learning about this while I have this opportunity.
That's really, are there a lot of hops grown in that area?
Not then there were.
Oh, okay.
So we basically served as the educational extension people for people in not just Vermont, but New York and Massachusetts and Quebec. And there's probably some other states around, but it was more like a regional thing because hops weren't really grown in the Northeast then. And it's starting to pick up now. I know New York had some incentives for a bit for people to start growing hops and, you know, invest in the local brewery scene. And since then, one of my old colleagues in Vermont, he started a hop farm there that's now the largest hop farm in the region. But at this point, there's still not that many, but it's growing for sure.
That's really cool. I want to get back to your experience, but I also want to talk about hops because this is,
yes.
I'm interested in this. You know, we grow grapes. This is grape country where I am at as well. We do, or it's turning into grape country. We do lots of cotton, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of people diversifying into grapes. So it's all about the wine around here. Mm-hmm. So that's really fat. Are there other uses for hops aside from beer?
Honestly, we focused on the beer aspect,
okay. And
I'm sure there are other things that people use it for, but I think, I mean, similar to beer, I've seen, like, flavored waters with hops in it, and maybe some, like, I don't know, I'm sure there's some kind of salve or something with hops in it, but principally beer.
I was just curious, because I know it's, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it's, you know, related or in the same family to cannabis. And there's
yes.
A lot of
various uses for that, and it's being, you know, grown medicinally, industrially, recreationally, everything else. I don't know anything about it, so I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, some of my old colleagues might be listening to this and saying, "No, Julia, remember this," but I do not remember. It's been a couple years since I was in that scene, but it was one of my favorite crops to work on. It was a lot of fun.
Cool. That's really interesting. Okay, so that brings us, I think, so you studied agronomy, plant genetics, which is over my head as, you know, nerdy horticulture guy. And then
it was agronomy heavy, plant genetics light, so don't ask me any genetic questions.
Oh, I don't even know the questions to ask, so don't worry. And then you started your PhD. How's that? You're almost done. You should be finished this fall, right?
Yep, that's what they tell me. it's going pretty well, I think. I actually just yesterday made my first two figures for my dissertation,
yes, so I'm there
very
you go.
Excited. But I did my master's, and that was kind of narrow, I guess, so to speak.
Sure.
Like, my projects were laid out for me. They were really cohesive together. PhD, not so much. It just went, kind of exploded into a lot of different directions. But I am working on winter oilseed crops,
okay,
principally for the agronomy part of things. Pennycress and camelina, which most people have never heard of. So it's been fun. They are in the brassica family, closely related to canola or rapeseed.
Okay.
And so just identifying, well, the problems have been identified and looking at some of the agronomic best management practices for them, how to get them into the corn soybean cropping rotation so that we do not disturb our beloved Midwest corn soybean crops. As you may be able to tell, I am not the fondest of corn and soybean, but that's okay. So many people are. They can take care of that for me.
Sure.
And then on the flip side of things, I am looking at science communication and podcasting as a method for communicating science that people might not normally hear about, like what you're doing. I'm trying to do it too, sometimes successfully, sometimes unsuccessfully, but it's a lot of fun to have that diversity in my PhD, and so hopefully I'll finish up and say, yeah, I did that.
That's
well.
So cool. I have no doubt that you've done a great job. I really, like, again, I love your podcast. I think it's excellent. I think you do a good job of telling the stories that you're trying to tell, like you said, in a different way. And it's an important thing. If you don't mind, I've got a couple of questions just about that aspect of your research, because
yeah, go for it.
Now I don't know how to ask them. I think that's a fascinating thing because, you know, because science communication and I think probably some of the circles that we sort of spend our time in, whether it's on social media and in person, et cetera, and the podcast community and the science community, it's something we talk about a lot. But I feel like in some ways, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, that the body of literature on the benefits of that, you know, not specifically just podcasts, but like public outreach science communication in a non-traditional sense, I feel like that's maybe limited. I feel like the research is maybe limited.
Yeah, it is pretty slim from what I've seen. I mean, I've looked at, you know, podcasting specifically to be like, okay, what's been going on in this realm? And science podcasting, there's like 5 articles, maybe a few more than that. That might be an exaggeration, but there's very little research on podcasting. There's been a lot actually with medical students and students in, you know, undergraduate courses as like a review type method.
Okay.
That came out very clunky, but for reviewing materials before exams, but with communicating with the general public, there's not a lot of information. And like in science communication in general, there has been quite a bit of information about that field, but podcasting is so, maybe not so unique, but unique in the sense that it is principally a one-way,
right,
one-way communication device. And in science communication principles, it's talking about it has to be two-way. You have to be getting feedback. How are you to know what's going on with your listener base if you're not talking with them? But with a podcast, I mean, I'm talking to you over Zoom in my office, but a lot of the time it feels like I'm just talking to myself in my office, and it can be difficult. But yeah, the science communication world, I think, is still figuring out what to do with podcasts, because clearly they work to some degree. People are listening to them. People are excited about them.
Yeah.
But how does that translate with the things that we already know about science communication? I don't think we know yet.
That's so fascinating. So how is that part of your research structured? Are you doing surveys? Are you and don't give away anything you don't want to give away, I understand. Yeah. But
so this part of the research, it hasn't been completely solidified at this point, if I'm being honest.
Sure.
And it's one of those things that I'm working with I have two committee members who are helping me develop this project, and I am working with them to learn how to create a good survey. So it will be survey based.
Okay.
But surveys are not something I have a lot of experience in.
Sure.
So asking questions that will give me the answers I'm looking for is a little bit, it's hard. It's a lot harder than it sounds, is what I'll say about surveys.
Oh, absolutely. 100%. 100%. So half of my, or actually 2/3 of my dissertation was actually survey based as well.
Okay.
And I, oh gosh, you know, and I worked for Extension too for a while before I came back to school. And sort of concurrently for a little bit. And so trying to build this, I was like, okay, you know, we did a field study, and that's, I'm not going to say it's easy. Field work is not easy, but it's straightforward in some ways, right? You set your response parameters, you set your variables, and you go out and you do the thing and you collect the data and you have the data. But then you throw people into the mix, and people are messy. And the way that
very much
and messy and biased and maybe not definitely not objective most of the time. And so structuring a survey to actually give you like discrete usable data is certainly a challenge, certainly. So that's quite the undertaking. That but I'm curious, and I'm excited to hear in the future kind of where that goes.
Yeah, so at this point, it's going to be structured as kind of two different surveys, actually. One will focus on the people listening to the podcasts. Right now, the last time a podcast listener survey went out for Science Podcast specifically was, the data was published in 2007, so it was earlier than that. And that was like at the dawn of the podcasting era, so the landscape has changed a lot since then. A lot more people are listening, and those demographics might be a little different. And that was also just looking at one podcast listeners. And so I'm hoping to open it up to maybe some of my podcast friends to, you know, share with their listeners and just see like who's listening, what does that, I don't know, look like. And so, I mean, that may not be particularly interesting for most people to listen or hear about and read about later. And that's fine. That's not, I guess, the fun part, that's kind of the maintenance part of the survey, so to speak, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Just to like get an idea of what's going on. But then the second part, the second survey, I guess, will be more for people who have been on science podcasts and talking about, how did you prepare for this? What do you wish you had done differently? How could the host have helped you before getting into like the podcasting session? And more information for people who are preparing to go on science podcasts. And so that'll be more qualitative, I guess. It'll be talking about people's personal experiences and trying to find connections and similarities between those, and just serving as hopefully a kind of a guide for people, hosts like us in the future, and then people who are hoping to be guests, and give them a little bit of a resource for, okay, what questions do I need to ask if this person is not, you know, giving me like the information, or like what questions do I not even know that I need to ask beforehand to prepare for this? So I'm looking forward to that part, I think, most of all.
Okay, that's so cool. And again, I got my nerdy like communicator plant guy brain going, because that is such useful information that, you're right, doesn't exist. It's just not there, not really. And so to be able to have something to say, oh no, this is what the data says about the types of questions to ask, the ways to prepare for it on both sides of the microphone, or you know, whichever end of the conversation you're on. That's so cool. I love that.
Yeah, I think it should be really, really fun and interesting. And so I'm hoping to be able to put that. I had thought August, but it takes time to make sure it's ready and right. So September, hopefully.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll see what it says. I think it will be interesting and hopefully useful.
That is very cool. Very cool. And I think, you know, in the grander scheme beyond that, you know, as an educator, as someone who works in academia, there's not currently, and there are positions and there are places, but outside of extension, there's not a lot of incentive to do good science communication, to do the public outreach. And I see that starting to change in some places. I'm fortunate to have a great department chair and great leadership that sees the value right now in our college and in our department specifically of things like this, things like what we're doing right now. And that's huge. And I don't know if people listening out there who are maybe not initiated into the world of the university and academia understand how big of a thing that is. Mm-hmm. But the data will help.
I'm
going to be your like biggest cheerleader about this. I think that's so cool.
Well, hello there. Welcome to the mid-roll. Fancy meeting you here. All right. I don't know why I always do that so creepy. Anyway, I don't have a lot to throw at you for this mid-roll, except to say that you should go connect with Planthropology all the places. We are on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. If you search for Planthropology, which is anthropology with a PL slapped right on the front, and look for the bristlecone pine with the green background, that'll be me and all the weird podcast glory. You can also find me and whatever was left of my self-respect over on the TikTok machine at the Plant Prof. I guess TikTok post video, whatever. I have videos about plant stuff, academia stuff, whatever ridiculous nonsense pops into my head. There's a good chance that I will be wearing a pumpkin on my coconut at some point between now and, you know, Halloween. That's, you know, no promises, but it might happen if I can find one big enough, which has been a challenge so far, by the way. But connect on social media, join the Planthropology's Cool Plant People Facebook group, which is a lot of fun. There's lots of conversation, questions, answers, memes, all kinds of good things. Also, if you would go and leave me a rating and review, I would so much appreciate it, whether on Podchaser or Apple Podcasts. It means a lot. Lets me know that I am doing the things that I need to do. I wear a size 5-star review if you would like to get me a gift. But more importantly, I would like you to just be honest. Connect either through social media or email. You can email me at planthropologypod@gmail.com and let me know what you think. If you are enjoying the show, I would love to hear that. If you have some tips or tricks or advice for how to make the show better, I would very much like to hear that too. Lots of stuff coming up between now and the end of the year. I'm hoping to try to do some like live recordings on social media, maybe next week when I'm going to be releasing an episode of my Plants and World Traditions series about probably tree planting, I think. Yeah, let's do tree planting. Why not? Let's give it a shot. And I'll probably try to live stream that on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram if I can figure out how to do that. And I would love for you to join me and ask questions and all the things. But anyway, that's all. That's the whole mid-roll. Back to the show. All right, bye now.
So kind of getting back to the plant side of it a little bit, you're talking about winter seed oils or researching winter seed oils. Did I say that right?
Winter oil seeds.
Okay, yeah.
It's all the right words.
You know, that's my brain kind of works in the right order sometimes. Can you talk a little bit more about that? What are you looking at in that aspect?
Yeah, so I am looking at a few different things, but the idea of using winter oil seeds has come about in the upper Midwest, so Minnesota and the surrounding states, because of that corn and soybean production that's just so omnipresent here. It's everywhere. It's what everyone's doing. And that can be good in some ways, but there's also negative impacts of that. We have a lot of nutrient pollution into the Mississippi River. We have a lot of soil erosion in the winter because there's nothing on the land after people are harvesting their corn or their soybeans. And I mean, I think this is everywhere, but there are herbicide-resistant weeds that are, you know, not able to be suppressed in that corn-soybean rotation anymore. So this kind of came about of how can we put something else in the rotation to help break up the corn and soybean kind of monotony, so to speak, on the landscape, and provide growers with tangible benefits like you get with a cover crop. But I think this is very, very common across the U.S. Cover crops haven't really caught on as much as maybe we think they should.
Right.
Even though they have an amazing multitude of benefits, from suppressing weed growth, from, you know, decreasing soil erosion and nutrient runoff, but also sequestering nutrients to stay in the soil for the next year. And, you know, just there's a ton of benefits of cover crops, but they haven't caught on. And so my predecessors and, you know, my mentors said, how can we change that? How can we get something that's going to provide environmental benefits and break up the corn-soybean rotation? And they came across these weeds. Well, okay, one of them is a weed that's in early stages of domestication. The other one has been cultivated for many years, but it hasn't been broadly cultivated. But they can provide a return on investment, essentially, in a more tangible way than a traditional cover crop can in the environmental sector. But this provides, like, real cash benefits. Cash now. So I am looking at some of the just basic agronomic management aspects, because we're really early still in this. How do we manage this crop? How do we get it into the rotation without disturbing other things? So in pennycress, one of my crops, I am principally working on harvest timing. That's what my master's was on. And I have a project that's a continuation of that to apply essentially chemicals that kill the plant desiccants mm-hmm. to the crop to get it off the field as early as possible and harvest that seed so we can plant something else. And I guess one of the other cornerstones of this that I didn't mention is they're planted in the fall and harvested in the spring.
Okay.
Which is kind of novel for this area because our growing season is so short. And then my other project in camelina is kind of a beast of a project. We're looking at the cropping rotation, so using corn relative maturity, then planting camelina, and then really cropping soybean into it. And all at that time, looking at the environmental aspect of things. How is this affecting, like, carbon and nitrogen in the soil? How is this affecting carbon loss from the soil in terms of emissions? So it's there's a lot of things going on, a lot of moving parts, but it is fun to have, you know, not be like bottlenecked in my projects. And that was a long-winded explanation to kind of get to that point.
No, it's fascinating. And that's, again, meaningful, I think, really important research. When do you sleep? Do you sleep?
I do, actually. I think I sleep more than people would think I sleep.
That's impressive. I'm glad to hear that.
I'm very dedicated to time off and evenings off for the most part. So I get a lot of sleep. It's nice. I know the academic world is not always conducive for that, but I said, nah, it's not that important. I'll finish it when I finish it.
Okay, we need to talk about that, because that is, okay, it's so refreshing to hear you say that, because academia is this cult of productivity. And
yes.
And we wear our 16-hour work days like badges of honor, but which is, if you're out there listening and you're like, well, of course I do, it is so unhealthy. It's so self-destructive, or it can be. It can be. There are some people that like that, and that's how they want to live their life. And I'm not trying to tell anyone how they should be. But goodness, work-life balance is important.
Yeah, doing it just to keep up. I know so many people that are on that schedule just to stay on top of things. And it is, oh boy, it is something to behold. They, you know, get a lot of work done, but also, the burnout is real.
Oh, it's real.
So many people.
Yeah. Well, and so I'm curious, is that something, you know, you've been in the academic world for a while now in different capacities, and as a student, as a researcher, as a teacher, and, you know, a TA, all these different things. Was that aspect of it, of, okay, my evenings are mine, my me time is mine, is that something that you came in with? Or is that something you've had to kind of learn and develop along the way?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, so I guess fortunately for me, I am just kind of wired that way. And I know a lot of people aren't, and that I think that's a really hard learned skill. Mm-hmm. It is a skill to set those boundaries and have that work-life balance in me time. But no, I was able to come in and kind of set those boundaries. And it was also helpful that my advisor has always been a big supporter of, if you need time, take time. If you need time off, take it off. You don't have to be working on evenings or weekends. Like, work in the time that works best for you. So actually, evenings are the time that I often work best. So like during the day, I'll just be like hanging out, doing whatever. And then in the evenings, that's like my time when I'm most productive. But there weren't a lot of, you know, the expectation is that the work gets done. Mm-hmm. And if those deadlines or targets need to be moved, they can be moved. It's not, I like to think of academia as saying it's not that important. Like, these things will get done. I think sometimes people conflate their research that they're doing, that it's, you know, the next greatest, amazingest thing. And some of it is, but, you know, most of it, it will be important to someone, but it's not going to change the world, which maybe is a jaded view, but it, I think, has helped keep me humble and say, okay, I don't have to kill myself for this. I can take the time that it takes.
I don't think that's jaded at all. I actually, in some ways, think it's quite the opposite. Because we've built this system, and I say we because, you know, we all feed into it. We're all part of mm-hmm. it. It's easy to say, oh, the whoever, you know, 100 years ago, however many years ago, but we're all part of it. We're all contribute to the system. But we have this system where it's like, if you're not, we're made to feel sometimes, I think, and I say this as a, you know, kind of early career guy. I don't do a lot of research. I do some, but if your next paper is not earth shattering, if you're not, you know, solving or resolving relativity or the climate crisis or whatever, what are you doing? And I think that is the attitude we've unfortunately built when. Mm-hmm. Science doesn't really work that way. Science is the composite of lots of little discoveries. And we make the big discovery sometimes, and that's so cool, but then we have to validate it with follow-up little discoveries. And, you know, some of that, in my opinion, and I'm sure I get myself in trouble saying things like this, and I'll not, so this is Dr. Baliga's, you know, opinion, but we, because of the way we view publishing, because of the way this whole thing happens, it's like, you can't, it's hard to publish negative data, right? It's hard to publish, but that is how science works. We have to figure out what doesn't work just as much as what does work. And so, you know, I'm soapboxing. I'm sorry. This is about you, not my.
No, I completely agree. I've had so many conversations around, okay, we did this thing and it didn't work. What? We want people to know that it doesn't work, mm-hmm. but there's this stigma around, I guess, quote unquote, failure and being like, well, this experiment failed, question mark.
Yeah.
And so, or it didn't work in the way that we anticipated it would. And so we still want to tell people about it, but it just seems like we don't see that very much. But just learning what doesn't work is just as important as what does work. And, I agree. We should see more of that.
And, you know, I can scream about it till I'm blue in the face, but I think a lot, and I've talked about this before, I think a lot about, you know, the first humans that discovered what we can and can't eat. Right. And, you know, mm-hmm. oh, Carl ate that berry and Carl's dead now. Right. That is important information. It is important to know which berries not to eat as much as which berries to eat. And I don't know. I think that there is, but what's encouraging to me is to see, you know, I'm probably a few years older than you, and I'm going to generously lump myself into your generation of researchers and academics. But, like, I think there is a group now coming up through academia, the PIs, the researchers, the leaders of tomorrow that maybe see things in a way that, like we're talking about now, that maybe can break through some of the issues that have built up over time, that we've allowed to build up over time. And that for me gives me a lot of hope for the future of academia and the future of research and the future of science in general.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, sort of off of that, just the way we communicate the information, like we're not just relegated to publishing it in a paper. We can do it in a podcast now, and that can be more freeform where you talk about what maybe in like a, you know, more colloquial sense, what worked, what didn't work kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or, you know, online meetings as opposed to, you know, these big field days where it's like, okay, we have 1 year. We have to like save all our best information for that. Having little online meetings to be like, okay, we can talk about not just the big stuff. We can talk about the little steps that it took us to get there.
Yeah.
Things like that. So I think there's maybe more avenues to talk about that in addition to it becoming a more acceptable part of academia when for a long time it hasn't been.
Yeah. Well, and that actually is a perfect segue. And we've talked about your show a little bit at this point, but I really want to get into that a little bit more here in our last little bit. What gave you the idea to start it? What made Julia say, you know what, I need a podcast?
Yeah, so I have always been a big podcast nerd. The first podcast I listened to was I started listening in 2006,
oh, wow.
I want to say. I listened to a Harry Potter recap podcast,
yes.
Which I had, at that time, read them all the books that were out multiple times. But hearing someone talk about it, you know, chapter by chapter was, I mean, kind of my favorite thing about podcasting to this day. It's like sitting with a friend, and even though you're not actively maybe a part of the conversation, you can still have that kind of sense of belonging to like this group of like maybe something niche that you don't have a lot of people in real life to talk about with or not nerding out as hard on it as you are. So I have always loved podcasts, and I've kind of carried that with me passively into grad school. I didn't come into grad school saying, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do the long con and start a podcast in my PhD. But it really came about when I was finishing my master's. I had these two field projects handed to me, and that was, you know, what funds me. That's what pays the bills.
Yeah.
But my advisor came when we had our meetings, just said, I want you to find something that you're really interested in, and I want you to create a project around it. It can be whatever. And so that was a very stressful scenario to be in for a while because it was the kind of thing where I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it for like 2 or 3 months. Because there wasn't a strict deadline and one I had to have it figured out by, but I was like, I really want it to be the right thing. And then one day it came to me. I was like, oh, one of my favorite parts of being in graduate school and before then being in extension was getting to communicate this science with people, not in this kind of like high jargony way, but like coming and breaking it down and getting to talk with people about the research that is happening and, I don't know, learning about it in a more friendly, familiar way. And I said, a podcast. That sounds like maybe a route that I could take in my committee. That was just my agronomy part of my committee at the mm-hmm. time was like, well, we don't know anything about this, but if you can find people that can, you know, shepherd you through this project, go for it.
Hmm.
And so I set out on that journey, and here I am now.
That's very cool. So how is your show structured for those that haven't heard it before? What can they expect if they go listen?
Yeah, so every other week-ish, I have an episode out. We were just chatting, you and I, Vikram, before the show, that I admire how you are able to put out a show so regularly, and I fall off the bandwagon sometimes.
You know, and that's okay.
But every other week, I talk with a guest, and they tell me about their research. And so it's the first part of the show was pretty interview style because I was getting comfortable with the medium. It's, mm-hmm. you know, a learned thing. And I'm trying to now shift it to a little bit more conversational where we're not like, okay, how was the experiment set up? What did you do?
Right.
What did you find? And just more having a conversation around it. But it is, even though I'm in plants, as we've been talking about, I decided to open up my show to a broad variety of sciences. Some of my favorite science podcasts for a long time, especially when I was doing lab work as an undergrad, were some of those kind of general science, general information shows. And I said, I really like that. Mm-hmm. I also want an opportunity to learn about something other than plants. I can go talk to the people I sit next to and learn about plant stuff, or go to a conference and learn about it. So it is kind of a conversational interview. It's about a variety of topics, not just plants, though there are a lot of plant episodes on the front end.
Sure.
From when I was talking with my, you know, colleagues and friends, trying to get a little more comfy with it. But we, just have a chat about the science. There's a good amount of kind of background information because I'm walking into the episodes as a novice. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything about any of these topics for the most part. And then we kind of get into, you know, the experiment, what you found, what happened, what just kind of what was going on, and then maybe some kind of future implications for that.
That's really cool. And it's a lot of fun. I think that, like I said, I really enjoy the show, and I enjoyed that format too. And then I really enjoy the conversational. So I think that, and I think you've made that transition well. There are some podcasts out there that I've heard that try to pivot at some point, and it, you know, for whatever reason, sometimes it doesn't pan out, and that's fine too. You know, every show's different, but I think you've done a really good job of kind of creating the conversation around whatever you're talking about.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I've tried to work on my conversational monotone, which listening back, I was like, Julia, you are interested in this. You can't just say, that's so cool. Okay, next question. Respond. So that's something that I've personally been working on to make it, I think, hopefully more engaging experience for other people.
No, I love it. Like I said, you're doing a great job. So we'll kind of start wrapping up, but what's next for you? I know that's a big question, and I don't want to put you on the spot, because I remember, you know, being at that, oh God, I just want to survive my dissertation phase, which wasn't that long ago for me. But
yeah.
What are your thoughts on like where you go, whether personally or with the podcast or whatever else?
Yeah. So personally, I'm planning to move out of Minnesota.
Okay.
I'm from Vermont. It's not the Midwest. And so I'm hoping to move, you know, coastal again. It's my personal plans. Uh-huh. And then my professional plans are hopefully to pursue a career in like data as a data analyst. So that's kind of taking my favorite parts of doing PhD work and translating them hopefully to a real life job. I do not have one lined up, but this is my fingers crossed for the future. So I would be looking at data and distilling it into, you know, figures or text or, you know, just the main points to give to a company that I'm working for to say, okay, this is what we learned from this data set, either from, you know, consumers or from a project or whatever it is. And staying kind of in the back end of maybe what the traditional research process looks like. I don't want to collect the data anymore. I'm ready to move on from that. But I'm hoping to do that. And I get a question about the podcast a lot of, are you going to do the podcast after you finish school? And I'd like to continue it. It'll, you know, probably be a little touch and go while
sure.
I'm figuring out the rest of my life.
Uh-huh.
But the podcast has been so fun. I'm sure that you've also had this experience of meeting new people and connecting with new colleagues from like Twitter.
Yeah.
I love Twitter now. It's a great place to learn about people's research and then, you know, send them a DM and say, hey, you want to come on the show? But I'm hoping to continue that too. So
very cool.
Lots of hopes for the future.
That's very cool. And no, I totally agree. Like, especially through the last year and a half of, you know, very limited social contact, you know, ideally, theoretically, whatever. It has been very nice just getting to like have people to talk to, if nothing else.
Yes.
You know, just like I can have. So I have a 5-year-old, and, you know, during the however many months of lockdown we had here, I was like, I need, and my wife was at home too, but at some point we were both like, we have to talk to other adults. Like, we have to have a conversation that's not about whatever, you know, Barney, not Barney. We don't watch Barney. Blue's Clues. We watch a lot of Blue's Clues. I totally am there with you that it has been just such a great outlet and such a good way to just make new friends.
Yes.
Which is,
yeah, very refreshing way to, I don't know, experience life. I think even without the pandemic, I think the pandemic really pushed me to be like, okay, who can I talk to on the internet everyone, and it opened up the horizons of who to connect with in a so much broader sense, at least for me, and then the podcast. So
that's really cool.
It's really great.
So what I always wrap up my episodes with is asking my guest for a piece of advice. And it can be about anything. You know, I tell people it could be about, like, you know, maybe don't eat hot dogs that are expired or whatever. It can be about plants. It can be about school. But, like, if there's one thing that you would like the people listening right now to take with them, what would that be?
I think, you know, kind of hearkening back to what we were talking about, making sure you're taking the time for yourself. And I know self-care is like a buzzword right now, whatever you want to call it, but taking time and investing in yourself, whether that's, you know, starting a new hobby, like a podcast, even though it kind of is like quote unquote work, it's like work you want to do.
Right.
Or, I don't know, just like having a quiet evening where you just like spend time with yourself. And maybe that's not what people want to hear after a long time of being alone, but whatever that looks like for you, take time to, you know, do what makes you happy and not what other people expect you to do.
I think that's excellent advice. And I think that's something that in our society in general, people need to hear and be given permission to, and it's all right. You know, it's all right.
Well, it's hard to defy the expectations of others sometimes. Yeah. So.
100%. Wow, that was so good. I learned a lot, and I've got a lot of thoughts in my brain now. I would like to have you back on sometimes, maybe after you finish up and you've got, you know, some on the other side thoughts from some of your research. I'd love to hear where that went and what you found and get some more information about that.
That would be great.
Where can people find you?
So people can find me personally on Twitter. Oh, man, I don't even know what my Twitter handle is. Let me pull it up real quick. They can find me there. It's just I don't know how they do that. It is at jcubins, which is J-C-U-B-I-N-S. And I like to tweet about random things, like how the other day I felt like a Victorian ghost in my house just looking out the window. And then when people see me running away really fast and then some like science. But a lot of personal ramblings on there, if that's what you're interested in. And they can find the podcast also on, I'm very familiar with these social media handles, so on Twitter, at Hooked on Science, on Instagram and Facebook, at Hooked on Science Pod. I post episode announcements, I guess, and any sort of extra content that guests may have given me, and occasionally, you know, if there's something related, I will post that too. So
very cool. Well, y'all, Julia, thanks again for being on. I really enjoyed it. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
And to all of you out there listening, take some time for yourself. Go look Julia up all the places on social media. Go look up Hooked on Science. Keep being cool and keep being nice to each other. Unless you haven't been, then start being nice to each other. And I will talk to you again soon. Y'all, protect your time. I mean, no one's going to do it for you. More is always asked of us. And I say this as someone who's really bad at doing it. But Julia, I think, has a really interesting perspective on it. And I think that I think learned a lot maybe about how to be in academia through recording and then re-listening to this episode. So protect your time. It's important. Balance is important in life. Y'all, thanks so much for listening. You know that I think that you are the very best humans. And thanks as always to the Texas Tech Department of Plant and Soil Science for all the support and all the just ability to do this, just the time to do this. And it's meant the world, and I could not do this without the support of my department. Stay tuned. Like I mentioned, next week we'll have an episode of Plants and World Traditions talking about trees. And then it'll be October, and that's super wild. So I hope you're doing well. I hope you're staying safe. Keep being good people, and I will talk to you next week.
You've been listening to a podcast of the Podfix Network. Discover more audible gems like this at podfixnetwork.com. Make sure to catch up-to-the-minute network shenanigans by following at Podfix on Twitter, official_Podfix on Instagram, at Podfix Network on Facebook, and make sure to subscribe to Podfix Presents wherever you choose to find podcasts. The Podfix Network, artist owned and loved.